On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
We're getting closer to Christmas, and we have a very special guest with us today to talk about a really special book. We're welcoming Martha Bolton, who is the first woman staff writer for Bob Hope, who helped to write his TV specials, personal appearances, and military shows for 15 years, an Emmy-nominated writer and author of 88 books of humor and inspiration. She has received nominations for a Dove Award, a WGA Award, and a Golden Scroll Merit Award for fiction. She, along with Linda Hope, the daughter of Bob and Dolores Hope, are the authors of Dear Bob, Bob Hope's Wartime Correspondence with the GIs of World War II. And it's from the University Press of Mississippi. Really delighted to welcome Martha Bolton to On the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be on your show.
The wonderful thing about this book to me is that I had certainly known that Bob Hope went to see GIs all around the world for most of his life, honestly. And I always was very impressed by that. And I had read about him starting out going to see the U.S. military bases during World War II, but I really didn't know a lot about it. Your book has a world of information about the places that he went and the people that he took with him, but also these incredible boxes of correspondence that he had back and forth between GIs starting during World War II. So it's really quite a treasure trove for anybody who's a fan of Bob Hope to pick up a copy of your book.
Well, thank you. And, it, at the height of World War II, he was receiving 38,000 fan letters a week.
Wow.
So you can imagine what it was like for the secretary then, and then also for Linda and I, having to go through all that. Mm-hmm. And make selections, because that was the hardest part, was deciding which letters would go in.
Right.
You know, we're thrilled with the end result, and people are really enjoying the book. And like yourself, learning a lot about Bob Hope that we didn't know before.
Yeah.
And those letters are such a peek into his heart that we knew that he was close with the GIs, and he'd do anything for them, and they would for him. But, in their own words, going back and forth, and you see the why of that connection, and it's eye opening.
Yeah, it's not for nothing that you use the phrase "the soldier in grease paint," and there's a section in here that talks about that he, like a lot of guys during World War II, wanted to go ahead and get in the service, and he was told in no uncertain terms, "Sir, you're doing us so much more good visiting our troops and encouraging them and entertaining them than you could ever do in actual wearing a uniform." But
exactly, but
now one of the things I learned from your book is that he is the only person ever to be named an honorary veteran of the U.S. military.
Well, there's been one since, but he was the first.
Right.
And what an amazing, groundbreaking honor. And it was something that was near and dear to his heart, for sure. He was very touched by that. And when Roosevelt told him that, that your services would be better entertaining the troops and keeping their morale up, I don't think Roosevelt even knew the kind of man that he was getting, that he would take it not only for World War II, but for every war in his lifetime.
Yeah. There are so many wonderful stories in here, and the one that stood out to me was he's in his 80s at this point, I think, and somebody approaches him at a restaurant and said, "Gee, sure would be great if you could come see the troops such and such." And he gets a phone and calls the White House and says, "Hey, Ronnie, can you work this out?"
Isn't that a great story?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that was him, that he just... All the, the presidents, the generals, they were all just a phone call away. He'd go pick it up and caught him, it was Reagan at the time, and caught him in the in their bedroom. He was watching an old Western, and he interrupts the president and says he's ready to go, It's just amazing.
Yeah.
He was one of a kind. Oh, my goodness. Just one of a kind. Everybody loved him.
That's what comes shining through this book, that the real affection that these military members had for him and that he mm-hmm. had and that he reciprocated toward them too.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And they he would do anything for them, not only in war, but he kept it up in peacetime. And if they needed anything for the troops, he'd take it to the people, he'd take it to Congress, and if he had to, he'd take it to the president. He was their champion.
Now, the first year he got involved in this, he had had a very successful year out in Hollywood. He had rode to Zanzibar, Caught in the Draft, Nothing But the Truth, and Louisiana Purchase that all came out in 1941. But also what happened in 1941 is the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and even though we knew that war was going on all around us around the world, we had managed at that point to avoid that kind of direct contact with it, but now there was no ignoring it. And he sees this as a summons when he has an opportunity to entertain. And he doesn't go out to see tens of thousands of guys at a time either. He'd go anywhere, anytime, wouldn't he?
Well, he'd do both. You know, if it was a large crowd, which he certainly drew plenty of large crowds. At the end of the book, it shows some of the crowds that just one summer that he entertained. But if he heard of if he was on one island and appeared for 30,000 people or 38,000 people, troops, and then he would hear about another island that couldn't, you know, they couldn't come over to hear him, but they sure would enjoy a show, he'd get the pilot, and even if it was bad weather, he'd get the pilot, talk him into letting them, you know, taking them over there, and he'd put on a show for them. Or if there was this one soldier that wrote that they had walked, him and his company had walked 10 miles to see the show, and by the time they got there were so many thousands on the hillside that they couldn't really see or hear Bob, so they just turned around and started walking back. And word of that got to Bob, and afterwards he got in a Jeep, and they took him out and found that group on the road. And he parked and put on a show, a private show, just for them for 40 minutes in the rain.
Wow.
Incredible. And you wouldn't know those things if you didn't read these letters.
Yeah. At one point, there's an article in a Seattle newspaper saying that he had entertained soldiers in Fairbanks and other places in Alaska 58 shows in 8 days.
Isn't that incredible?
He must have had the stamina of Goliath. I can't imagine how he didn't get sick or so exhausted that he couldn't go on, because he never seemed to get too exhausted.
I know. But he did encounter, sometimes he did get sick, but he just would push through it and he kept on going, and he got a jungle rot, they call it, on his foot was one of the things that he, you know, took home for a souvenir.
Yeah.
And people would ask him, you know, how he felt about that, and he said, if those guys could lay down their lives and face, you know, a lot more than what this is, I could do this, you know. Mm. He had it all in perspective. He knew who was really sacrificing. And he was going to be there for him for sure. And he did his own sacrificing, but he knew who was doing, the main work.
We're talking, if you're just joining us, to Martha Bolton, who is the writer and compiler with Linda Hope of Dear Bob, Bob Hope's Wartime Correspondence with the GIs of World War II. It's from the University Press of Mississippi and available at bookstores and online everywhere. It's hard for us who were not living during that time to realize how important his Tuesday night radio broadcasts were that were carried on the Armed Forces radio network. So GIs all over the world in bases that could pick up the show on shortwave were listening to him on Tuesday evenings, and how important that was for the GIs and the sailors and the Marines and the airmen and the support personnel and everybody that was far away from home, particularly at Christmas time, where it seems the most acutely that you would be you would feel separated from those that you loved.
Right, and there's a whole section in the book that says, you know, dear Bob, we won't be home for Christmas, and it's all those letters from the GIs that are, you know, missing their sweetheart, missing their families, and they just pour out their heart on these pages, and Bob was so keen on that, and that's why he would go visit them at Christmas, and he and his family gave up their Christmas until after the holidays, and then they'd celebrate with the family, but you know, for Christmas, it was him and the GIs, and sometimes his family traveled with him, but that's where they were with the GIs at Christmas time. He knew how important it was.
Yeah, there's a little story about Irving Berlin. Wrote White Christmas as well as thousands of other songs, but I never heard this anywhere, and I'm a big fan of Irving Berlin too, that his only son died at the age of 3 weeks on Christmas in 1928.
Isn't that so sad?
Yes,
and then they visit, him and his wife visited the child's grave for every Christmas after that, and I'm sure you know, that played a lot into his music, and it's so sad.
It's fun that Bing Crosby and Bob Hope were really friends in real life, not just in movies.
Right.
And did appearances on each other's radio shows and so forth. It's hard to believe that Bob Hope had the energy to continue to go and go and go, and his wife Dolores. She must have been quite a remarkable woman that she just knew how important it was, and in her own way was just as big a contributor as her husband, because she had to take care of the kids and run the household, and she volunteered and everything else while he's off either making movies or making trips to see military personnel at bases around the world.
Right, right. And she not only gave him the freedom to do that mission, but she was every bit a part of it. You know, if she heard that the GIs needed something, she'd be on the phone. She was very much a part of that mission.
Now, of course, he started out on radio. When television came along, he had Christmas specials that aired for 45 seasons, which is just amazing, 1950 through 1995. Our younger listeners, you'd really missed something wonderful in that if people, when TV first came out, so many different entertainers did Christmas specials, and you had one chance to see it, and then it was gone. You know, it wasn't like streaming is now. And I can remember as a kid sitting down in the 60s watching the Christmas, Andy Williams and Bob Hope and Bing Crosby and everybody's Christmas specials. This was such a great time of the year. And even though he did that, he didn't not go see, you know, he didn't say, well, I've got to do this special, so I'll block out the month of December. He went and saw GIs anyway, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And he just, He loved to, you know, to be there for the guys on Christmas, you know, to wear, and then to, you know, he would sing Silent Night. He'd bring stars over, and they'd give up their Christmas to entertain the troops. And he got some of the highest ratings on those shows. People just, all of America was watching him, and then looking in the audience to see if they could see their loved one, you know, their family member that was over there, and they took such great shots of the guys and girls that, you know, watching the show and whatnot, and always a tearjerker.
Yeah, yeah. The it always ended each event with at Christmas, during Christmas time, with everybody singing Silent Night together, and
yes.
And what an incredible sensation that must have been for the soldiers and the sailors and Marines and airmen to have that moment of solidarity with everybody else in the world singing along with them.
Absolutely. And, you know, not a dry eye out there on the field with them, and not a dry eye at home watching. So
yeah,
it was very moving.
Now, there are reproductions of a bunch of people, a bunch of Christmas cards that were drawn by GIs through the years, and particularly during World War II, or V-mails from the CBs at Christmas and so forth, that were sent to Bob. And once again, this is another indication of the great respect that they had for him, but also the fact that they felt like he was one of them. And a lot of the letters express that exact sentiment, don't they? You're one of us. You're not one of those stuck-up Hollywood types.
Oh, yeah. Oh, exactly. And they wouldn't be, you know, dear Mr. Hope. It was dear buddy, dear pal, dear brother, dear dad, you know.
Yeah.
They just were very close to him. He was one of their family. That's how they, even from their first letter, from their first exchange with him, they would be on a familiar territory like they knew him. It's remarkable. I don't think of, you know, other stars that get that kind of fan mail that they're your friends.
Yeah.
You know, it's usually, you know, they're in awe of this celebrity and nothing much happens other than, you know, one exchange with them. But these guys and girls, they were, you know, it was ongoing. They'd write back and then they'd write back again and then they'd write back again and he'd write. It was this ongoing relationship. And he would invite them if they were ever in California, in the Hollywood area, you know, come watch the show. He'd tell them, just tell them, any GI, you know, just come on in and come up and say hi to me, you know.
Yeah, and they weren't kidding. He wasn't kidding either. This wasn't just the kind of thing that people say, oh, you know, when you're in the area, be sure to stop by.
Exactly. No, not at all. He was sincere about it. So he made it happen if at all he could. And one thing that people don't know too is that if a GI could get up close enough to him at a show to hand him his or her mother's phone number, then Bob, when he got home, and this is after the tour and the long air flight home, he'd go in and start making calls to these moms and telling them that he saw their son or daughter.
Yeah.
And pass along a good word, you know.
That,
it's amazing.
That's just incredible that he would actually do what he promised he would do and follow up with their folks and let them or their wives and let them know, hey, I saw your boy the other day. You know, he said to say hi. You know, imagine.
I know, or your husband, and it's you know, there's letters in there that show, just as an example of the many 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 hundreds of letters that are along that follow along that occasion of letting them know.
Right.
You know, so he lived up to his word on so many promises that he made. It meant that much to him to be faithful and to make those calls. And you could tell by the soldiers' letters back how much that meant to him, or the mom or the dad.
Right.
They'd write back and say, you'll never know what that call meant to me.
Yeah. Yeah, and can you imagine your kids off at war, and you're sitting around the house worried about them, praying for them, and you get a phone call, and that's that that absolutely recognizable voice saying, "Hi, this is Bob Hope." And,
oh man, yeah, you drop the phone, you know. But man, what a memory for that family!
Yes,
you know,
yes.
For the rest of their life.
Yeah, and some of the letters that you include say things that you would expect, like, you know, thank you so much for doing that. Our son died 2 days later at this battle or that battle, and that means so we will cherish that phone call the rest of our lives.
Yeah, and knowing, and they would say knowing that our son got a little bit of laughter before he left us. I mean, it's just, it was so meaningful that their son or daughter got to see him. And then also that he made the call, you know.
Yeah.
It's just the power of those kind of acts that we all could do. It's we think it's too small, or it's not going to, you know, it's insignificant, you know, but it's not. It means the world to people when you do things like that. And Bob knew that. Bob Bob knew that early on from his career. I mean, he knew that these are the kinds of things you do. And he would even, a lot of them, and they'll, you know, mention this in their letters too, is that he would add them to his Christmas list, his Christmas card list. And they would say, you know, the Christmas after you were here, I got a Christmas card from you, and I thought that was special, but since you were here, you know, you know, I understood that that's probably why you did it. But then year after year, you kept sending them.
Yeah.
He just did. I mean, he had to have had thousands on his Christmas card list. He just would remember them at Christmas. And like you said, for the Mother's Days, he would contact moms and just was so good at that. And they would write and ask him to, you know, can you play this for my mom? Mm-hmm. You know, get the radio to play this. Or he was just their connection. He was their connection to home. He was their connection to whatever they wanted or needed. And he was the go-to guy.
That I had not ever thought about, but your book talks about that, of course, this makes Bob Hope a prime target for the Axis. You know, if they
absolutely
can capture him or kill him, they know it's going to be a huge morale thing. And happily enough, they were never able to do that. Providentially, they were not, but that didn't mean they didn't try.
Oh, I know. They got close a couple of times. He had some close calls where they were hitting just behind the stage, and he'd make a crack about it and go on with his jokes. You know, he just, for someone who played such a coward in so many of his films, he was fearless. He just nothing fazed him. He'd make a joke out of it. I think whatever happened, he just would look at it, you know, with a funny slant and go on.
Yep. He seemed indestructible, and happily enough, that seems to be the case. But
hundred years old,
And he made fun of himself all the time. I mean, there's some great jokes in here. I would never try to do a Bob Hope impersonation and read these jokes, but they just crack you up because you can hear his voice as you're reading the transcript of it, and hear him saying these things and his wonderful timing and how really funny it would be. There is a picture of him with the Tuskegee Airmen in 1943 in England, and I mention that because Tuskegee is about 35 minutes northeast of Troy, and so the Tuskegee Airmen, you know, they're South Alabama's own. You know, we honor them. We are so proud of them. We embrace them. And to see that picture is really a lovely, lovely thing. But he's got lots of pictures with lots of people all over the place. But the funniest thing, I think, were the people who found pictures of people they thought looked like him.
Oh, I love those. Those are so funny. And they would send them to Bob, you know. And you can imagine, you could just imagine his response when he opened it. And he's like, oh, my goodness. And what would happen is a bunch of them would send them the same picture because wherever they were at, they'd all discover these pictures. And they really did look like Bob.
Pretty scary how much some of them do.
But there are about 250, something like that, photographs in the book, and a lot of them are from Bob's personal collection. So it's just a treasure trove of photographs and stories and you know, these letters, and it's just a fun read and full of historical significance as well as good humor. You know, Bob, like you say, it sounds like him on the page when you read these jokes.
Yeah.
You hear his voice. And then also, you know, the tear-jerking ones are just so powerful. And and the whole book, it just reminds us to be grateful to all of the soldiers that laid down their life, all of the troops, and what they did for us. And he knew it, and he wanted to keep the country informed of what all they were doing. Like I said, even after the war, he continued to champion the troops and what we owe them and for us not to forget.
Yeah, yeah. His legacy for us, I remember reading, and it might have been one of your other books, that that his daughter, Linda, toward the end of his life, made some comment to him about that they'd been notified that he could be buried in Arlington Cemetery, which is a huge honor. As someone who never served in the military, there's very few people that are eligible who aren't veterans. And by that time, he was already an honorary veteran. So he was eligible to be buried in Arlington. And as I recall, the anecdote that she asked him, would he prefer to be buried in Arlington or with the family cemetery? Yeah. And he says, surprise me.
Yeah. He was very quick-witted.
Yes, indeed.
But he did, too. They buried him with the family, so that's where he is.
Well, it seems incredible that it was 18 years ago that we lost him. But what an incredible legacy! And this is so sweet for you to get somebody that knew him so well and to work with his daughter, whom I know that you must have known through the years.
She used to produce a lot of his shows too, so we worked together and all of that. And then it was a story that needed to be told, because it was, like I said, it was such a look into Bob Hope's heart, and a lot of people weren't aware of how much he did for the troops and how close they were to him.
It is certainly a great way for people who know who Bob Hope is but weren't around during World War II to understand the significance of all of those trips that he made and the people that he took with him and over again. And one thing that what stands with me is that he would tell them before they went into a hospital where there would be wounded guys, he would say, nobody cries while we're in there. No tears, you know.
Yeah.
After we get out, that's okay, but not in front of the guys.
And he was passionate about that because they were there to make him laugh.
Right. Well, it's a great book, and I enjoyed it so much, and I was really tickled to get a chance to talk to you because I've read your books before and enjoyed them very much. And I wanted to say thanks for the laughs.
Well, thank you for having me on the show and helping us get the word out for it.
Absolutely. Our guest today, Martha Bolton, who is the writer and compiler, along with Linda Hope, of Dear Bob, Bob Hope's Wartime Correspondence with the GIs of World War II. It's from the University Press of Mississippi. Their website is upress.state.ms.us, if you want to check their website and find out about this book and others. Martha, do you have a website as well?
Yes, it's marthabolton.com.
Easy
That's
to remember.
Pretty easy.
I like that. All right, very good. Well, once again, thank you so much, and I hope that you have a very Merry Christmas.
Well, thank you. You too, you and your family. Thank you so much.
And this year at Christmas, remember, as Bob Hope always did, that there are men and women around the world who are serving in our military, who are keeping us safe. We're not actively involved in a war right now, but most of Bob Hope's life, there were wars around the world in which American personnel were involved, and he went wherever they were to share his affection for them and to entertain them and make their day a little bit better in the midst of a very difficult and stressful situation. Once again, Dear Bob, Bob Hope's Wartime Correspondence with the GIs of World War II, written and compiled by Martha Bolton, our guest today, along with Linda Hope, his daughter, again from the University Press of Mississippi. Here's hoping that you and your family have a wonderful Christmas. From all of us at WTBF Radio and from onthebookshelf.podbean.com, we'll see you next time. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Dr. Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.